raise expectations any higher than that. I'll keep it there. But I'm sure you'll be awesome. So, Dawn.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Dawn, and I'm an alcoholic. As mentioned this morning, I'm also a grateful member of this fellowship, the Al-Anon Adult Children of Alcoholics. And without my left hand and my right hand, I don't know where I would be today, honestly. Marty talks about me sharing my AA story, and honestly, I don't know if I can do that because it's so integrated. And my recovery is the base of both of these programs. However, I have this ability to just kind of put on an AA lens and put on an Al-Anon lens. And all these different kinds of ways of looking at situations and things in my life that really just help me get a fuller, bigger perspective. And sometimes I get really stuck, and that's what the beautiful part about sponsorship is, having somebody there to really help me buoy me up to the surface and bring me back up to true perspective. So I don't know how this will go, how it'll come out, but I believe that somebody will need to hear it this way, because there's a lot of us who walk both worlds. And I guess starting with my story, that that's a lot of what my story is walking a couple of worlds, more than one world. So a little bit of a fractured self, double identity. I came to AA, and in thinking about actually the theme for today's event, opening our hearts, and to me, the entire journey here, it's about the journey from the head to the heart, as my dear friend Louise likes to say. And when I came here, I was very much in my head and about thinking my way through my problems. And we're just going to get down to solving all of this, and I'm going to fix it. I'm going to figure out a way to fix it. And I burnt up all my energy in the mental exertion of trying to like push a river current backwards up the river, and I didn't have any energy left to really be concerned about anybody else but myself. So the journey from the head to the heart. But when I think about my AA story and where I'm coming from, it's really been the journey of from coming from human creature to human being, and that's how I look at it. I was a bit of a creature back then before recovery, but in the sense that in the most humanistic way I can say, I was trying to get all my needs met in the wrong ways. And the need for love, the need to be validated, the need to be a part of something, the need to be cared about and nurtured, those are the things that I really feel were absent from the childhood. And so, AA takes me from this place to, okay, you're an alcoholic and that's it. We don't know why. There's an allergy and that's enough. That's all we need to know. And there's just this kind of dead stop to self-discovery in that sense of, why am I an alcoholic? When I came to Al-Anon, it was a year into AA recovery. That's when I was able to kind of sift and sort through some of the origins of my disease, and in that process begin to understand myself in a more humanistic way. And I guess that's my word of the day. I've been saying that a lot, right? But that's what the journey from the head to the heart is. It's for me, it's been this person who's stuck in the rational, and now moving down into the person who feels their way through life. And it's the switching of the head is number one, the heart is number two. It's actually been a very slow evolution from, the heart is number one and the head is number two. And it's like my head has become my tool. My mind, my intellect's become my tool, but my heart leads. And that to me is spiritual awakening. That to me is how we impact other people and really effectively pass on all of our pain and share in that place. So, you know, getting the needs met in all the wrong ways and walking two worlds, more than one world, probably. I'm a First Nations person who's very white passing. And I didn't grow up in my home community. My father had been kind of fractured away from his community and really had no identity with his heritage whatsoever. And my mother, although she had some identity with it, we grew up without any culture. And it was dry alcoholism in my home. So by the time that I was born, the youngest of five, the alcoholism was more or less gone from my home by the time I was 5 years old in terms of, you know, the outright, you know, presence of it. However, what remained was the effects of alcoholism, unbeknownst to my parents or to any of them, any of us. And so I didn't know why I felt always like I didn't belong on this planet. And like I should not even be here, really. I was kind of kicked around. I was kind of in the way, it always seemed. And there was a lot of, you know, just don't feel what you feel because, you know, somebody is going to tell you that it's wrong or tell you that you're bad. So I really deeply internalized a message of I shouldn't even be here. You know, and so that lens that colored every aspect of my life, everything that I looked at in the world was colored with that lens of shame. And so moving on into my upper years, I remember, you know, the tendencies that we have, the obsessive thinking. I was becoming obsessed with other people and kids and things when I was just young, when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old. I remember like needing to have that friend, this friend. Yeah, I've got this friend, that's okay, but I need to have that friend. And it was like a fixation, and I began to learn how to manipulate my way through life in order to bring people closer to me, to feel and to fill that hole in me. Because it really was. It was just this gaping hole of identity. And I didn't know who I was. So I had to look to everybody around me to tell me, you know, am I okay? Is this, do you accept me? Do you, you know? And by the time I got to, you know, 8, 9 years old, I really had a deep sense that I was really different than the people around me. And to the point where, you know, I was almost beginning to get angry, you know, at that young of an age. And I kind of just went around and just looked for acceptance wherever I could get it. And unfortunately, you know, the people who were accepting of me living in my family system and you know, they weren't the healthiest people either. And so I ended up in a situation at probably about 8 or 9 years old where I was sexually abused, and that went on for a couple of years. So not only did I have this kind of disenfranchisement from the self and this kind of, you know, pull and push into any direction for my identity, now I had a really dark, shameful secret. And that, you know, those were some of the cords that came up that sprouted, I guess, or grew into what was a budding alcoholic. There was alcoholism in the home who would have been amongst my brothers and my sisters, who were all older than me. And I was very impressioned by them. And so a lot of it was not so much what my parents did. Although I blamed my parents for everything, it was actually really a lot of the hurtful situations and internalized shame that I received, it actually came from relationships with my siblings. And I say that because I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. We do tend to focus on the failures of the parent and whatever. But there's, you know, other dynamics happening in the home that also affect us. So about 12 years old, that's when the anger really kicked in. And I didn't know why I was angry, but I knew that I felt ripped off and that somebody was to blame for this. So at a very young age, I already had the victim mindset. The victim has to blame, has to find someone to blame. And where did I point to? Well, I pointed to my parents. If you had been this, then I wouldn't be so screwed up. If you had been that, if you'd done that, then I wouldn't feel the way I feel. I wouldn't feel so in the depths, dark and full of shame. So when I was 12 years old, things really started to go south. That's when my critical thinking kicked in. And so everything was criticized in my mind. Everybody, everything was stupid. And that's when my ego really started to rise up to take me from that place of shame up, up, up above anybody else. And so all of the, you know, in AA they talk about, you know, lack of power. That was our dilemma. Lack of power. And so when I think about power, I think about, you know, being this child who felt very powerless over anything. I just, you know, we're all born into this world and we just have to kind of figure it out. And there's things already going on and we just kind of get thrown in and we just have to figure out how life works, right? And I mean, for all of us and any of us, I believe, like, if there's any reason to just be a little bit, you know, kind to ourselves, it's for that reason alone. But I started to feel really angry and I needed someone to blame. And the target was the parents. And then I found, you know, my solution. I was really deeply in depression. I did a lot of comparing myself to other people. And all I could really see in the world was what was wrong. What was wrong? What was wrong with me? I just kind of walked around the world and I just, I was highly sensitive, you know, growing up in that alcoholic home, highly sensitive to people's emotions and energies and things. And I just, and that overburdened sense of responsibility, I just kind of absorbed everything. And I realized, you know, later on that, you know, the things that I saw going on around me in the world, I really didn't like to see and I didn't really like to feel, but I didn't know how to get rid of them. And so I just took them and I absorbed them into me. And then all I knew how to do was to stuff them down. And so all of that anger and that pain that was stuffed down, it didn't get processed out. It didn't get, you know, I didn't outlet that in a proper, healthy way. And so it hardened and it turned into resentment. And I resented the world. I resented everything. I resented ideas. I resented. So as I grew through my teen years, you know, it's an understatement to say how cynical I was and how, but I was one of those silent, brooding people. And, you know, I resented Christmas. I resented that somebody said, bless you, when I sneezed, because that is, you know, somebody's trying to impose their religion on me now. Like, we're getting down into this kind of mindset here as a teenage girl. And so I turned my back on the world. And I remember the day that I turned my back on God. I really did, because I laid there in my bed thinking, you know, all these people with their, you know, they've got something I don't have, and I don't know how I'm supposed to get that, but all I know is I hate them and I resent their happiness, and I resent all of the wonderful things that they have and their families and their white picket fence, and I said, you know what, if this religion thing and God and whatever, I'm never going to be good enough for that. I'm never going to be all of the misguided ideas that I'd picked up loosely from, you know, these religious ideas about, you know, I was never going to be good enough for that. I thought I had to be perfect. And so I turned my back on God and I made that decision. I literally made it. And when I think back, that's where all hell started to break loose in my life. I found alcohol. And let's not joke, like before that, I was very impressioned by the alcoholism and the party lifestyles of my brothers and sisters. I grew up watching, you know, 80s rock videos and all of that stuff. So, I mean, the messaging is everywhere, right? But I'd found my solution, and what alcohol did for me on that very first time, it just like wrapped me. It just wrapped me in this sense of comfort that I'd never, ever had in my life. It was like I was like an electrical cord that was like raw, and it wrapped me and just kind of grounded me down. And I couldn't wait to try alcohol for the first time. I remember being 9, 10 years old, and it was like, yeah, I can't wait till I have a life. I can't wait till I'm, you know, and so the really distorted thinking that was happening in a very young age, I mean, it was there. So it was almost premeditated, but at the same time, you know, the conditions were set up for that through no fault of my own. So in AA, we talk about the causes and the conditions. And to me, as I searched through my program, I couldn't get down to, why am I an alcoholic though? Like this just doesn't suffice me, you know, to just, what makes a person an alcoholic? And to do all these selfish things I've done according to this inventory, and what would drive a person to become that selfish and to do some of the things I've done? And I knew in my heart, you know, I'm a good person. I am at heart a good person, but I've made a lot of really crappy choices. And what's that from? Where does that come? So I found some of that answer in Al-Anon. And so the causes and the conditions, you know, and to understand that there is really this system that I'm operating in that's, you know, within my family, within my, you know, community, and, you know, if we want to go farther within the entire globe, about, you know, that was setting me up to be in this. And so that's not to point responsibility and to say it's the system's fault that I'm an alcoholic. That's not what I mean by that. But what I mean was that was the day that I was set free, so that I didn't have to, that's the day I was set free that, Dawn, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. You made some decisions. Yes, you own that. You drank enough to the point where your body became reliant on alcoholism. And you know, all of the fallout from that, that's what you're responsible for. But the world, as it works, you're not responsible for that. And so that was a lot of freedom for me when I came into recovery. So I go into my teen years, and the other wonderful, I guess we'll call it an addiction, I picked up was unhealthy men, and they just fall hand in hand with a party lifestyle. It's they just come right in. How do we do that, right? And so that's something that's just innate in me, right? And so, you know, there was always that intermix of you know, unhealthy relationships, alcoholism, or drug addiction, you know, and so I talk a lot about power. And so I was always in these relationships in my life, and I think about every one of them fit into some sort of category of either we were neutral to each other, or they were up one rung on the ladder to me, or I was up down one rung on the ladder to them. And it was, I was always good with the neutrals, you know, but I always felt down one rung on everybody. And I had a lot of relationships that were suppressive that way, where these people probably wanted me down. And that lack of power, my dilemma, was really a huge triggering flare-up for me. So the source of relationship pain that I had came from that place. And so I spent my entire life, from the time I was very young on, trying to get up that rung, trying to climb up onto anybody who I needed to. But you know, it's interesting how I said how we can kind of sense these things, right? We feel each other. There's this power dynamic that starts between me and whoever it is I'm trying to climb up on, and we start to push on each other, and it gets really tense. And one of us won't let up, but neither of us will let up. Nobody's even talking about this. This is all happening in some sort of subtle way, but I'm trying to exert some power here. And that's coming from that deep message of you know, you're powerless. You need to climb. You need to get up on people so that you can feel safe. And so I spent my whole life in these types of relationships where it was never just harmony. It was, although that's all my heart ever really wanted. It was like, why can't we just be harmonious and love one another? But I didn't realize I was as much in the game as anybody else, right? And helst, if I was going to forgive you, or, you know, I was going to be very selective about that. And so I had a lot of silent resentments, and I had a lot of silent power struggles going on. And that was a real big problem in terms of just trying to have, you know, some peace of mind and harmony in the world. All I really wanted, right? So I came to recovery. I learned how to step outside of power dynamics. And that's been one of the greatest gifts to me. So in terms of, I do tend to skip around a little bit. In terms of identity and walking two worlds, you know, I always felt like I was somebody who was a little different. And I felt like I viewed the world differently than other people for some reason. And I think that's almost kind of inherent in our upbringing. On top of that, I was an Indigenous person with an Indigenous heart, but I didn't look Indigenous. And I didn't live Indigenous. And everywhere I went, I just kind of felt like I was washed out. Like I don't know where I fit. I don't know who I am. I don't know, you know, I'm not seeing my kind here. I'm not experiencing my kind here. And identity to me has been a huge cord through learning to love myself and learning to get down to who I really am. So stripping away the cultural stuff and on my journey from head to heart, stripping away the ideas that I had about what it meant to be an Indigenous person, and how I needed to be, and I'm not accepted by these people because I'm too brown, but, you know, I'm not accepted by these people because I'm too white in terms of how I think and how I feel. That was a source of major internal conflict. So I was always just kind of fractured in that way. So getting down to the real self and some of the things that really in recovery woke me up, I guess, is, you know, looking at being an Indigenous person living here in Canada. And I went to the same schools as many. I got all the same messaging, that free form kind of messaging about what it means to be successful and to be, you know, a contributing member of society. And I got all of the same messaging. But at the same time, I didn't know why I was different. I felt so different. And I realized that, you know, later on that there's a certain amount of memory that I had. I'll call it blood memory, because the blood remembers the intergenerational trauma that's been passed on from generation to generation. And you hear a lot about that in the news, and you might not know a lot about it, but really that trauma is passed on from generation to generation, and that I've certainly absorbed that from both of my parents and their upbringings and generations far beyond that. And when I started to look at it from that lens, I started to see that that's also not my fault, but I started to look at it a little bit beyond that, to, okay, so, you know, residential schools happened and, you know, family systems were broken and, you know, the introduction of alcoholism and all forms of, you know, horrible abuses and things have come into the picture. But then I started to look at it a little bit wider and started to look at, how that level of atrocity has happened all over the world in many, many different cultures. And I looked at a dear friend of mine whose father was raised just outside the whose grandfather would have been in the Holocaust. I mean, so just understanding that trauma has been passed down. And the moment that I realized, you know, this isn't just a me and my problem here. This isn't just like, Dawn, this is all your fault. You're a screw up. You're an alcoholic. This is a wider, a larger systemic issue. And then I looked at it and I looked like, whoa, this is global. This is like humanity. Let's think back to like all the wars there have been. And the moment that I realized that, it was like, boom. It was like free from self-pity. That learned behavior I had from childhood to get my needs met in any kind of way that resembled anything like love, I didn't have to do that anymore. So it wasn't a me and my problem, but it was still my responsibility. So I come to recovery, and through my 20s, I mean, it's a whole bunch of losses of jobs and, you know, rocky relationships and all of that, but I managed to hold it together, and I think I just kind of came from a stable enough home environment where, you know, enough of that was modeled for me that it was good. We had a very stable home. I had a nice home. My friends always remarked, you've got a nice house and all of that stuff. My parents were very much about, you know, the definition of success is, you know, you got a job, and if you support for your kids and, you know, you have all the stuff you need, and then, you know, we're all good. We've arrived, right? And that just didn't work for me, because why did I feel so awful when I still had, you know, everything that I needed? And so, my 20s, it was just the emotional suffering. It's immense, right? When we're lying to ourselves and we're lying to our heart, when there's a fracture between what's true in our head and our intellect and what's actually really true in the heart. And it was a lifetime of lying to myself about who I am, about what I'm about, you know, just trying to find some kind of rational reasons why I should be justified to just, you know, meet and satiate every single desire that I have in the world, because isn't that what the world is for? Like, drink more, eat more, let's have vacations, let's, you know, I really bought into the idea that this is what life is about, and there's so much suffering around that when a person can't be true to their heart, and about, you know, in touch with who they are as a human being. So I come to recovery when I'm 29 years old. Actually, before that, I decide I'm going to get married. I've been with this longtime partner. You know, can't really escape each other. We need each other. We're all meshed in, and, you know, we're this thing, and it's not even like, it's like this deformed and very dysfunctional when... I decide, okay, I'm going to get myself clean for a while. I'm going to dry out. I'm going to see what that's like, because my parents did that. That's all we do. You just dry out. You just remove alcohol from the life And then all the problems with blacking out, the problems with, relationships and cheating and all of the drama and the violence that I tended to have, or the suicidal episodes I tended to have, those will all be gone if I just remove alcohol from the situation. And I really believe that. And it seemed to be working for a little while. It really did. It was like, I got motivated. I went to the gym and I knew how. It's true. I went to the gym, but all I knew how to do was focus on the exterior. Melody Beattie has this reading, substance over form. And, substance is what's on the inner, form is what's on the outer. And all I knew how to do was be pretty. And to, get my next, survival need met by a man, and who's going to take care of me because I can't take care of myself. And so I went to the gym. But in that, I got a taste of the freedom of life that was not a shame-inducing lifestyle. So it's not like I had this big, huge mound of shame inside of me. And then every activity I did just poured more shame on top of that shame. And it was like a big bowl of jelly. And I just jiggled around as I dumped more shame onto it with my alcoholic tendencies and behaviors. So I was able to kind of cut that and get a taste of what it's like when the bowl just stops shaking, But I didn't know that the bowl really needs to be dealt with here, actually. And I went on, and I just did what I thought I was supposed to do. I still went to parties. I still hung out with all the same people. I did all the same stuff. I just wasn't actually drinking. And it's almost like if you sat in the room with me, you would just feel my anger and my resentment at the fact that these people don't have to change, but I do. Why do I have to go to this length? Because I'm the one who's violent. I'm the one, but I'm not as bad as that. And I was never, And my nerves would just be on edge. And it was like, why am I doing this? Why did I even try to quit drinking? Because if I feel this way, what's the frickin' point? I feel the same way I felt when I was 12. So why don't I just drink? So after a year of white knuckling some sobriety, I did a couple of drinking episodes. But by then, my heart knew, you got to stop. And on some level, I always knew that I wouldn't drink forever, because when I was young, just maybe it's just how it shook out in my family, or I knew way too much about alcoholism, and I knew what it was. I knew how to get there, and I made that choice to kind of walk that path anyway, because there was like some freedom in that solution that I was experiencing that was a far bigger payoff than doing the right thing. And I never knew what doing the right thing was anyway. It was like, okay, Dawn, you can go out with this other guy, tonight from your boyfriend, or you could do the right thing. And then it was like, well, what's that? And then it's like, well, that's not very much fun though. And this really, really intensely drawing me over here. There's a lot of temptation. And I didn't have anybody to even ask what the right thing was, because I was so locked up in chains. Nobody could even talk to me. Like, I was one of those kids who gets in the car and sits in silence and then like stares out the window really angrily. And nobody could talk to me. So, unapproachable, unhelpable. And even if you tried to help me, I wasn't hearing you. You were like shut out. So I really, I had to arrive at these things on my own and in my own way, because there was no talking sense into me. There was no shaking me and saying, you need a priest or anything like that. It was just, I'm doing this my way. So I managed to make my way to the age of 29. I get married. We run off to Jamaica. And we're bitter because we can't afford a house in the housing market. So we thought, okay, well, we've got a line of credit. Let's just go blow that. And we'll get married, too, at the same time. Why don't we just throw it all into the mix? And, you know. And I did that. But you know what? Thinking back on that, that was the first decision I ever made in my life that I felt like was right in my heart. Like it was like the first heart decision I ever made that felt right. So we go off, we get married. I go on this 2-week long bender in Jamaica after having a dry period of about a year. So by this point, I've had 2 years of pretty consecutive non-drinking. And on this trip, it all comes out, right? All of the things I was thinking and not saying, and all my bridesmaids, I told them how much they disappointed me during the process of, you know, getting ready for the wedding. And I remember coming home on that plane and just being like, that's it. We're done. With the debauchery, we're done with the shame, you know. I really needed that big taste of, although it was not recovery, it was not sobriety, that taste of stable life that wasn't dumping shame on top of shame that hadn't been dealt with. So I had this friend who was a childhood friend, and she was a young person who was sober all of a sudden. And she came out one night, and I'd been drinking, and this is going back a little bit, but she said, yeah, I'm in AA right now. And I was like, what's that? And I was one of those people who was drunk, and I was hanging on her like, I'm so proud of you. And one day I'm going to be there too. But she planted a seed, and that's all she did. She planted a seed. I got back and I said, hey, so I want to check out one of those meetings. And she said, oh, okay, sure. So she takes me down to this meeting, and I still have my ego about me of, well, all you do is you just remove the alcohol. That's all you do. But the thing, the big throbbing question was like, how do you get sober and happy at the same time? That's the big mystery here, because there's alcohols everywhere. There's alcoholics everywhere. What are they doing? Somebody's happy out there. I know there is. There's a secret. So I'm going to go to AA and I'm going to figure out what that is. And I'll do what they do. And then I'm going to take that secret and I'm going to go off and I'm going to do it myself. So she takes me to this meeting and I judged everybody. And I was like, whoa, these are the real alcoholics here. These people, like, they're really struggling, and it's like, it's simple. All you do is you just quit drinking. So I'm one of these people who could just really white knuckle my way out into the world. But when I was out there, eventually the weight of the world without any resources in dealing with it got heavier and heavier, and it wore me down and it wore me down and it wore me down. Until eventually I'd have some sort of explosion, outburst, lash out, or I'd do something unhealthy. I'd eat it away, or I'd, if I didn't drink, I would, some sort of compulsion was going to be my out for it. And I couldn't manage life on life's terms. So I judge everybody, and I'm just not ready. I left there and things went really downhill from there. My relationship got really rocky. My job, I was in conflict in my job. I fell into a pretty deep depression. And I came to this place where I became willing. I just became willing to open my mind to some sort of solution. Because what I saw at that meeting was people who were laughing. And it was like, when was the last time did I laugh? Like, I don't remember. And I was in that state of just like really drained seriousness, and everything is bleak, and all I can see is the darkness. And that's all that there is. And anybody who isn't in darkness is privileged, and they just are lucky because they were privileged. They were brought up in a good home, and they, you know, da da da. But it wasn't adding up. My story wasn't adding up anymore. You know, I was like, I couldn't get past that. Why were they laughing at that meeting? And how is it that they were talking about things that so honestly at their heart level, and admitting things that I would never admit? I would never tell anybody those things about myself that they were admitting and laughing at. How is it that they were, you know, able to have that sense of freedom? And that's how I ended up in recovery. So I came in at around 29 years old. And like the skeptic I was, you know, there's no God, there's no science. Science doesn't prove that, so it's not real, you know, and don't try to push that on me. And so I kept my distance. And I watched with a very skeptical eye, and I was looking at what everybody was doing and what they were saying, and you know, and I really wasn't going to allow myself in as long as there was a chance that I was going to be fooled by these crazy people, right? These people who were really, you know. I didn't know what I was starving for at the time, but it was such, it was the deepest starvation. It was for human connection. I was so lonely. I was out there in the world trying to figure it all out, trying to, you know, fix my life, fix my people, fix everybody else. And then I had my hands all wrapped up in everybody else's world because now mine looks like it's pretty stable compared to them. And I was going insane. I was going insane. That you know, that restless, irritable discontent, they call it in AA. And I wasn't figuring out why my solutions weren't working. And I opened my mind that one day, this much. And I said, okay, I'm going to go to this AA meeting. I'm going to go back. And I looked up at this meeting list. I went by myself this time. And there was a meeting across the field from my house. It was like across the park behind my house. It was right there. I walked there. And somehow I just kind of, you know, slid in. And I came a few minutes early. And I just had this cordial conversation I would never have had with these two older men who welcomed me. And that was my introduction into recovery. And from there, I began to actually listen. You know, what are these people doing that is making them happy? Why are they laughing here? Because I'm very serious and I don't know what's, you know, and I'm still looking for the secret. So I'm like, oh, you guys have a book. Okay, I'll get the book. And I'm eyeing up this book. I'm like, how much is the book? How much is the book? And so like I said this morning, I went to this meeting and I felt pretty good after. And then I went back to another one and another one. And finally, I actually didn't dart out the door. I stuck around and nobody really talked to me. And I was like, see? And then the next time I stuck around a few minutes, and like I mentioned this morning, my sponsor found me, my first sponsor. And she handed me the big book, and I went home. And by this time, I'd heard just enough to be really intrigued by these kind of ideals or this kind of way of life that these people have. Because to me, I'm like, you mean there's a map to life? Like there's instructions? Okay. Like till now, it's been a free-for-all, and I'm failing. So I'm mad at all of you because I'm failing. And so... I went home and I started reading this big book. And at first I'm like, okay, yeah, first couple chapters, but there's enough there. And then I get into this chapter about God. It's called We the Agnostics. And And I'm like, yeah, okay, they're making some pretty good argument for why, you know, maybe there is or isn't a God and all of this. And I'm laying in bed one night reading this book, and I literally just sat up, and I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And I had to put it down, and I was like, you know, like grabbing my head and like, what is going on here? Like, how am I in this book? How am I in this book? How did they know? And so I'm in it, right? And I'd never actually related to something more than that in my entire life, to all of the passages in there. And what really sold me on AA and the program, I got to reading about step 10. And it talks about, there's one statement in there that says, love and tolerance of all others is our code. And that's the moment it was like, I'm sold. I'm sold. Because I didn't know that that's what I'd been wandering around the world looking for my whole life. Love and tolerance. Someone to love and to tolerate me. And someone that I can also love and tolerate. And so I end up in this way of life, and I started working the program and doing the do stuff and running around like a chicken with the head cut off, and I'm picking people up and I'm dropping them off, and I'm, you know, running, you know, emotionally sponsoring people I shouldn't have been sponsoring at all. I'm step 12-ing. I haven't even done the steps. I'm doing all this stuff, right? But it's good. I'm embedded and I'm working in the program. But you know what? It took me a heck of a long time to really get real. It took me a heck of a long time to move from my head down into my heart. And so I did a lot of my program from this place of exerting my mental energy and reading the theories in the books and learning all of that and speaking from that. From that place of trying to climb up on my rung on the ladder, trying to prove that, you know, I'm worthy in this world now, but don't you know? And I've got all of this stuff here to back it. And you know what the wonderful thing about AA is that all of that debauchery and all the stuff that I thought was just garbage. My whole life was garbage. I drank it away. I did all this just shameful, stupid things and whatever. In AA, that stuff actually counted for something. I was like, that's what I did best. That's what I did best. You mean that, like, I can have a story here and I can matter based on all of the crap that I did best? I tried to be the best at drinking at one point in my life because it was like, you know, that's all I know how to really do better than anybody else. And I've got to be better than somebody else, because if I'm not, then I'm bad and I'm wrong. You know, I'm down in that powerless state. So it was like, oh, okay, well, there's something here for me, you know? And, so it took me a while to move from my head to my heart, and Al-Anon sure played a huge part in that role. AA to me has a lot of, those universal, those axioms, those things that are true under all conditions, those universal truths. And AA to me is like the frame of the building, and Al-Anon to me is like everything that fills that building in. And I need both, you know. Learning to trust God, learning to move from my head to my heart, has been the entire journey. So trusting God, I did a lot of saying I trusted God, but my actions didn't align with any of that. It was like, what did I even bother saying I trusted God for? So it was still a lot of theory, but no practice. And I didn't have the self-awareness to know that, you know, I'm saying I trust God. God, I trust you, yes, but I don't trust you in this area, so I'll take over in that area of my life. Thank you. And while I'm at it, maybe this too. And so the journey, although, you know, I'd love to say has been just, you know, joyous and freeing. And you guys, any of you who know me, I talk a lot about I talk a lot about spiritual crisis. I've had a lot of that in recovery. And but in recovery, you know, you can't run anymore. I mean, you can. Let's get real. You can. But it's just God kept putting me back in the position of, no, you don't. No, you don't. And it was like I was like my one-year-old who she gets up and she runs off. And then, you know, you pick her up and you lay her back down. Gets up, lay her back down. Gets up. So so it was like a lot of that going on to where, you know, it's just getting honest. Getting honest at a deeper and deeper level. And that certainly has been the peeling of the onion. And honest with myself, but honest with others. And so I noticed that there was a big shift in me when I began to share at meetings from a place of imperfection rather than a place of perfection. Because I realized, well, that's what I need to hear so that I can recover. I'm not benefiting from hearing somebody just tell the same story over and over again, or talking about, you know, spouting about this and that, but never going into like, okay, how did step three affect you in 1974, the first time you did it, versus how does step three appear in your life today? Because that's the wisdom that I need. That's what I need to hear. And so there was a real shift in that, and I had to do some soul searching and get into a real vulnerable place to be able to share from a place of I don't have it all together. I'm actually just one of you. And so it's letting go of these old ideas that I had implanted. And the perfectionism was a really big one for me. And so I'm still kind of teasing out the ideas on this. But at a meeting not that long ago, I was talking about how, you know, that really deep sense of shame that comes up when you make a mistake. And we just can't shake it off, right? Sometimes, you know, a little bit here, but sometimes it's just there. And what that is for me is that shame, it's like it comes up in the body from like the root of you, the base of you, and it just sticks and it goes stuck right in your heart right there, and you just can't get that out of there. And what my perfectionism is, and what my ego putting myself up on that ladder is it's just like some sort of base container that I use to keep that shame from coming up to the surface, you know, from the bottom of the lake up to be exposed to the surface. That's how I control it. That's how I keep that, you know, in a place that's manageable. And so I've really had to dismantle all of that. And to allow myself a wonderful workshop this morning on feeling the feelings. I mean, what are they there for? My whole life I was told I shouldn't feel the way I feel. Or, you know, there was always the joke, don't tell Dawn anything because she'll just cry. So we're not just going to tell her anything. Don't tell Dawn. Just make sure you don't. And that it was very true. I mean, I was like that bowl of Jell-O that was always just shaking. And in any time, anything, little dagger or anything that just someone didn't accept me. Oh no, bowl of jelly goes. My whole life was about giving my power away to other people, and what they thought about me, because I was so externally focused on that. There was zero sense of who I am. So letting go of those ideas about who I'm supposed to be and getting down to my heart, you know, who do I want to be? Who am I really? You know, and starting to ask myself some deeper questions around that. And for me, that's been the whole thing. Continuing to uncover what's there. And when things come up, I don't try to escape them and run from them anymore. I try not to distract myself by getting too busy, by cleaning, by, you know, by you know, oh, I'll find an unhealthy man, or I'll, you know, some sort of distraction. It was like, no, you know the truth here. You've got to get down to it. You've got to honor it. What's it telling you? What can you learn about yourself from this, Dawn? And so continuing to strip away through the process of feeling and acknowledging, until there's nothing left on top of it. And there's, you know, the self in the truest form. And to me, that's spiritual awakening, because that's the God inside. You know, and you can tap into that source. And along the way, you know, we start to begin to flow rather than move as a mechanical person who is just a series of rational decisions and intellect and robot and you know, is this right? Is this wrong? Is this God's will? Is this my will? You know, my heart began to tell me what was true for me. And then I went through the process of okay, is this real? Is this not real? There's something strong in me that's guiding me to go this way, but it doesn't make any sense to my head. Okay, maybe take a step in that direction, feel that out. And that's funny how that started. You know, then the intuition, that's God talking to me. And I remember being at work, and I'm, you know, I'm into my recovery and I'm still trying to figure things out, but I'm driving one day, and I'm thinking about possible routes that I can go. Okay, I can go this way, the long way, it's a little bit longer. This way I could go the short way, you know, maybe a little bit more traffic, but yeah, I'm going with it. I'm going this way. So I get there, but there's a voice that's saying, go the other way. Go the other way. And I go, yeah, but, you know, I really don't feel like it, actually. I'm just going to go this way. I'm just going to, you know, it's faster. And so I go, and I get on there. I get on the bridge, and I'm, you know, reading. I'm trying to turn left. And then I didn't look ahead over to my left shoulder, which I would have seen the giant traffic jam going down the freeway. I'm still here, and I'm like, yeah, it's all good. And it was like, man, I got to be somewhere. Like, why didn't I listen to myself? Why didn't I just listen to that? And little things like that started to happen. I was at work, and I started to, how much? I was at work, and I started to, you know, do things. Like, I'd be drafting an email to all the staff for my job. I worked in communications for an Indigenous organization. And I'd be drafting this email, and I'd be like, okay. And in my job, I had a fair amount of leeway on how I wanted to do things, processes and procedures. It was very flexible. And I thought, okay, I'll send this off, and then I'll go about and I'll do these different, you know, steps. And then, but there's something in me that went, oh, you better check on that before you send this out, though, because it's going to make a big mess if you send it out prior to actually knowing for sure. And I said, meh, it's all right. It's going to be okay. I'll just, you know, and so I cut corners, and I sent this email, and lo and behold, everybody's confused. And now I've got managers contacting me, and I've got staff contacting me, and I'm just, then my shame rises up, and I'm like, oh, but I'm mad at them and not me, of course, because it's their fault, right? And it was, but really, I'm mad at myself. Dawn, why didn't you listen to yourself? Why didn't you listen to that? It was there. It was so strong. And that kept happening to me enough times till finally I was just in enough pain that, you know, how humility is reached through humiliation a lot of times. That's been my experience. Not all the time. And finally, I was just in enough pain over a series of mistakes I'd made, and I was just drained because I was beating myself up, and, you know, I wasn't perfect, and I'm di-di-di-di. And finally, I just decided, okay, it's time to start listening to that voice. I don't know what it means, but I'm doing it. And that really tailored into my spiritual experience. And it was like I pulled, began to pull a little thread, and I knew somehow internally it was time to delve a little deeper into understanding my relationship with God and why it is that sometimes I trust God, sometimes I don't. And I realized I had a lot of conditions on my relationship with God, just as I had a lot of conditions on the love relationships in my life. If you do this this way, then we're good. And if we don't do that that way, then we're not good. And I realized I felt really victimized by God, actually. And I felt like I was out of my control. And why are you doing this to me, God? And is this supposed to be easy now? This is all supposed to be better. I'm working my program. I'm doing my stuff. And what I didn't know was that, you know, I'd said the step three prayer in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, a passage of it, it says, God, build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. But it said, I asked God, and I meant that. God, build with me and do with me as thou wilt. And that's all God's been doing with me this whole time. That's all it is. Except for I expected, no, it's supposed to be easy now. This is all supposed to just, you know, flow, right? And so it's been a lot of learning. And for me, it's been about delving deeper and being willing to look at what's there, what is coming to the surface to show me that I need to look at it, and what is it not teaching me about other people and their problems and how they relate to it, but what is it teaching me about me? And as long as I continuously pull the focus back to me, then I seem to get by. You know, but when I start getting my focus out there and my magnifying glass out onto everybody else and what they've got going on, my disease starts to take over. So along the way, some of those things like, my esteem started to grow, right? Because I'm making good choices, making healthier choices. I'm getting in touch with who I am. I'm starting to feel pretty good about life in general. Things start to, you know, sometimes flow. Sometimes there's those real dips, those spiritual crises, those existential crises, and I don't know why I'm having them. I still don't get it, right? But every time I come out on the other side of that, of one of those, I would have a whole just like pocket full of jewels, of gold, things that actually meant something that I could pass on to somebody else. And so I began to slowly understand that all of this pain and these things that are coming up in me that I'm willing to work through, these are becoming my assets. So these are the things that are actually strengthening me. And the more that I hang on to my relationship with God as I go through them, the stronger that relationship and the stronger, you know, more resilient I become, really. And so my esteem started to grow. And so what happened was that, you know, along with the awkwardness of learning how to, you know, do the skills that we have to learn, setting boundaries and all of that, like, what's that? What's a boundary? You know, people started to relate to me differently. People who used to be generally pretty, kind of abusive to me on an emotional scale, started to actually treat me differently. Like they just sensed it. They sensed that power from within being established or growing, and that sense of self-respect and self-love that had never been there. I was always just a hollow little vessel waiting to be kicked around and told what to do. But now I've got this constitution in me, and people sense that they can't push me around anymore. And honestly, I think that's what happens with bullies. Really. I mean, they sense. They're using their senses and they're saying, yeah, I can have my way with that person, and that person. And that's where I'm going. I'm going up on my ladder and I'm going to take them down, right? And I'm going to inflict on them the pain and the shame that's been inflicted on me. And so, you know, the dynamic of all my relationships changed. And so I have less distraction in my life around things that are really like triggering and flaring, and the landscape for long periods of time starts to get really smooth. and starts to get really, so I'm not so distracted by my internal mechanism that's saying, this is wrong and you're bad and da-da-da. I'm actually able to apply my intellect and my things and start to look ahead at, like, what kind of person do I want to be? Where do I want to, you know? So it's an emotional stability that is, you know, gifted over time of working this program and these steps. And so with that, I guess, with that power growing, I began to know myself. I won't say even see myself, but see myself and know myself as somebody who is equal to every person who walks this planet. Whereas before, there was nothing in me that knew that. Everybody had my power. Any of you could have had it by looking at me the wrong way. Something as simple as that, or walking by me without smiling back at me when I smiled at you, right? Like, that's how easy it was. And I remember one day I was driving, and I had to take on, what do they call, affirmations. And so my affirmation, it was like, here's my affirmation, okay? Like, and I started to get mad at one point in recovery, and it was like, yeah, damn, I do have a right to be here. I do have it, you know? So but my affirmation was, Dawn, you were born equal to every person on this planet. You were born equal. And you're equal to the Queen of England. You were born equal to the pharaohs of Egypt, to anybody who has some sort of social stature or hierarchical sense of power. Guess what? You're equal. And I had to say that over and over and over to myself. And through that inner knowing and observation of myself going through the world and actually seeing how people were different to me, and that people actually respected me, and that I wasn't, you know, just somebody to be kicked around and to be, you know, and not to mention I was surrounded by many more healthy people. And so that's esteem building. But that social hierarchical kind of idea that society has about power and about who matters, it just falls away. And I realized I'm shoulder to shoulder with, you know, through the course of my work with very important people, some of them in politics, some of them have, people know who they are. They're on TV. They're, you know, these things that seem to be powerful to me, they're not. They're just another person. And I realize now that when I relate to people on the heart level and I live in my heart, I don't have to live in that power dynamic game and the hierarchies and the illusion of myself or anybody else being powerful or powerless. And I learned that, you know, things aren't just good or just bad, but they really just are. They just are. And I can stop assigning a value judgment to it based on how I might feel about it or how I might, you know. And if I'm really trusting God, then I know that the order of the universe and everything that's happening in it is actually really perfect. There's a part of me that would not be able to have heard that when I came into recovery 7-8 years ago. And that I don't actually have to do anything in order to fix it. What I need to do is to continue to live in that place of heart and that place of esteem and get down to, what is it that I value? What do I care about? Because I didn't actually have any of that growing up. I had no sense of self because I had no values. It was like, you've got a value, give it over here, because I'll go with that. What is it that I value? And now I can live from that place. And from that place, that's where I find where I make my contributions to the world. Because before, I guess on the old system, I'll call it, I did a lot of pointing and looking out there. This is all a mistake. We've got to get out there and fix it. I've got to activate, you know, become an activist, and I've got to do this and I've got to do that. And rah, rah, I got to fight my way out in the world, and we got to fix this. And now I know, you know, I really actually don't have to fix anything out there. I just need to, you know, go inside and fix myself if there's anything really to fix. The best way to change the world is to change myself and live from that place of example, live from a place of love, and show people what that is, what it is to be human, because there's so much of the inhumanity that is happening out there in the world today that's coming from this same similar disenfranchisement from the heart and living in the head. I'm not alone. It's not just me, you know. You can see it. And the sight began to elevate to where I'm not just looking at, you know, how can I get my needs met, you know, My sight actually began to elevate, and I began to see things from a much higher thought plane. And I began to see, you know, okay, so if I'm up in a building now, I'm looking down at from this building, I can see, that's why there's traffic over there. I can actually see why, rather where I couldn't see why we had the traffic jam because I was in the traffic jam. Now I can see why. Okay, oh, there's a river over here, but I wouldn't have known that if I was standing down on the street, but now I can see. And so to keep my perspective high enough to where I can see the truth and live in that true place that isn't completely ruled by emotion. It's fairly objective. Nothing is really personal unless I decide I'm going to make it personal. To stay up in that place, there's no better way than the 12 steps. There's just no better way than the 12 steps. I'm also a trained yoga instructor now. And yoga kind of has this world, and there's this kind of outside spiritual community, and some of them are into yoga and things like that. And I like all of that stuff. But there's a lot of people who are on a spiritual path, but they're trying to bypass their struggles. They're trying to bypass the pain, and they're trying to go straight to everything's good all the time, and I'm staying in the good always. And by that, to me, that's just an undermining of the human experience. And in AA, we're taught to be responsible for ourselves, responsible for how we show up in the world and what we put out there in the world, but not take on anybody else's stuff. And it's through that responsibility, that claiming of responsibility, that I've been able to let go of the victim mentality that ruled my entire life. I didn't have to point my finger anymore and blame. I didn't have to say, who's responsible for this? What's going on in politics right now? Sorry, I know we're not supposed to talk about that, but really, is it not just a bunch of finger pointing and the government screwed this up, they spent that money, they did it wrong. And, you know, it's this system of just shame and blame that we're living in. And so we come to these rooms, oh my God, there's refuge. Is there not? Isn't it beautiful that this is my refuge, really? And you think about how lucky we are to have a system where the power and control has been completely removed. So it's not that we're just chaotic and that we've got no sense of order or anything like that, but actually the hierarchy and the power struggle, it's an upside down inverted pyramid. So it's actually that the power dynamic is removed, and so we can all just be, and we don't have to actually be distracted by, you know, the powerlessness or who's trying to get power here, who's trying to climb the ladder, who's trying to whatever. We're not exerting ourselves trying to get stature or get some more money or a position or something like that, right? We can actually just be here in a base that is stable and clear enough so that we can actually recover. And I don't know what world you guys live in, but the world I live in, I mean, it's not like that out there. It's just not. And so, you know, that's the beauty, some of the beautiful things that I get here. Another thing that tends to happen is with this opening of the heart, you know, when you kind of get there and you really just start to live from that place, there's this expansion of your energy field. It's like this love, this radiating love. And people come into your field and they're like, you just feel soft. Why do you feel soft? You just feel comfortable. And that's, to me, there's just, what's there to say about that? It's just really that, you know, a person is really truly living in their heart. And it's at the place where others can sense that and feel safe. They sense it. Even if they're living in their head, they're sensing it. And they're attracted and drawn over. And they wanna know what that is, right? And so it's done through the process of continuously uncovering, being willing, being open to what I might learn about myself, and being honest. And I'm a person who, you know, I lie to myself like the best of us, right? Pride is a huge factor for me. And pride brings in a whole bunch of rational, intellectual reasons why they're wrong and I'm not. And, you know, and I heard an AA speaker one time say, if you have to defend, justify, rationalize, or explain yourself, you're wrong. And I've not found a situation where that wasn't true. I've not found a situation where that wasn't absolutely true. Because now that I'm in my experience and I try to observe myself and try to be a little bit objective and non-personal to what's happening in my world, I find myself go into a story about rationalizing, justifying, explaining, defending. And it's like, okay, Dawn, where are you wrong? And sometimes I'll be like, no. This is a matter of principle. There, you know, and then eventually I still have to get down to it, because it doesn't matter if who's right or who's wrong. At the end of the day, I still don't feel good. I still don't feel right, because I've gone into some sort of judgment value about this person to save myself from getting hurt, really. And to me, that's what judgment is about. It's about protection of self from other people, from the unknown. So that's a lot of different ideas, a lot of different experiences. At the end of the day, I would just say, keep working through whatever's there, because there is nothing that is not workable. There is nothing that is too big without asking for help. And it is not a journey of self-reliance. It is a journey of learning to be interdependent on one another in a healthy way. We've got so many beautiful experience and resources of people within fellowship, and outside help is also available, but there is nothing like what is here. And for myself, keeping my recovery at the core of all of my outer explorations that I do, my university education that I'm embarking on right now, the things I've learned about parenting, the things that I've learned about, you know, healing and energy and things, about yoga and the body system, about my indigenous heritage and indigenous worldviews, about all of these things, they all just braid together now. But at the core of that, I leave that at my recovery, that center core braid, strand of the braid. And as long as I do that, I know I'm safe. I know I'm good. But if I start going out here and I stay out here in, you know, some other world, some other solution, where I don't even, you know, have to do the steps anymore, and therefore I don't need to, you know, whatever. It all starts to go, go, go. I'm going to get lost. And so I'll leave you with that. Thank you.